It's Wednesday, April 17th, 2024, from Pete Fish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And you may have heard, you may have seen, that the incoming CEO, actually she's new, she's in place now, Catherine Marr, CEO of NPR, has a series of tweets that are up. In one, she, I'll quote it, had a dream where Kamala and I, Kamala Harris, were on a road trip in an unspecified location, sampling and comparing nuts and baklava from roadside stands. She dreamt of eating nuts and baklava with Kamala Harris. I have to admit, I used to have dreams of eating black licorice with former Undersecretary of the Treasury Stuart Eisenstadt. And I can't emphasize this enough. It was sensuous, not sensual. Okay? Everyone has their tweets that maybe they'd like to take back. You know, in 2017, Catherine Marr bragged, post-Thanksgiving, made it through dinner, zero turkeys sacrificed to the racist uncles. She then clarified, I don't really have racist uncles. It's just such a good gag. How could you not say this? When the discussion was, should we punch Nazis? She said, yes. I don't get this. Pretty sure my grandpa's marching orders were go punch Nazis and defend liberal democracy. She has tweeted that you should always trust structural privilege to show itself. Back in 2009, I mean, she was a Hillary supporter. She was a Biden supporter. Back in 2011, she wrote, with Elizabeth Warren running, there's finally a chance for Dems to get excited about 2012. I have a question. Who do the critics of Catherine Marr think the NPR listener is? The NPR listener is that. She's embodying them. She's like every progressive 40-year-old white woman who worked at or, in fact, headed a foundation. And if you're saying, wait, maybe there's some, okay, a tech foundation. She got paid hundreds of thousands of dollars in the nonprofit sector. Wikicommons was her gig. That person is always going to have a Black Lives Matter sign in her window, as she does. She's going to criticize the New York Times for running the James Bennett op-ed, as she did. She's going to give us the quotes that we all know that everyone gives. Quote, you're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. She said, quoting Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who she needed to tell us, Moynihan was a racist in his own liberal way, but even a broken clock is right twice a day. She is also, quote, so done with late stage capitalism. But you know what I say? I say, fine. This is obviously the kind of person who is very much understanding of what the NPR listener wants. She's the NPR listener. And even now, though NPR is going, experiencing some suris, as they say, from the Free Press essay by former editor, and my former editor in part, Uri Berliner, this Catherine Marr thing, I don't know if it's a sideshow. It does exemplify what NPR is. NPR has clarified, and this is true, the CEO doesn't have a part in news content. Of course, she's the CEO. She has higher fireability of the people who decide the news direction of the network. NPR has also said, and she has also said, when I was a private citizen, I was a private citizen. We're going to make NPR fair. But what is fair? Or, to quote a question that Catherine Marr was asking, what is truth?
That perhaps for our most tricky disagreements, seeking the truth and seeking to convince others of the truth might not be the right place to start. In fact, our reverence for the truth might be a distraction that's getting in the way of finding common ground.
This is also within the mindset, within the progressive, structural racism, late capitalism, quoting non-incredibly in-depth recitation of slogans, within that mindset, the what is truth? Whose truth is it? Question is very popular. The reason that sounds like it's about as deep as a TED Talk is it's literally from a TED Talk. She went on and did some more questioning of truth.
I'm certain that the truth exists for you and probably for the person sitting next to you. But this may not be the same truth. This is because the truth of the matter is very often for many people what happens when we merge facts about the world with our beliefs about the world. So we all have different truths.
And I guess that's fine, or has the patina of being fine, if what you're running is an activist collective or a pressure group, but not a news organization. Reverence for the truth is really important. And I'm sure she'd say, okay, that was in my old job where I got to do TED Talks and speak with a mellifluousness and everyone would nod along because they weren't thinking too deeply about the subjects at play. And it's also a fairly horrible thing to endorse in the age of Donald Trump denying and destroying the truth. So that was I always say that the one thing that saved us from total postmodernism in around 2020 was the fact that a full embrace of that would have played exactly into Donald Trump's hands. So as everyone who posted in this house Science Matters signs on their lawn was asking so chin-strokingly, what is truth? A good rebuttal would be, well, it's not what Donald Trump said, and we could all agree with that. Here, for me, for my journalism, for what I look for, I don't think about the what is truth as the guiding light and the way forward. It is true that it is true that we all come to the world with different perspectives, and we should also be open to our own perspectives being changed. But it's also true that our newspapers, our news organizations, our arbiters of fact, our arbiters of truth should forthrightly be in the truth game. And this is why better quotes beyond what is truth are quotes like Woodward and Bernstein. Woodward always says, what we do in journalism is the best attainable version of the truth. Not just facts, but of the truth. It's not a recitation of this thing happened and that thing happened. It's to put it in a truthful context. Marty Baron also said, we go to work, we don't go to war, when the Trump administration was impending. And A.G. Sulzberger, to pick a guy of a generation and a half younger than those two, who runs the New York Times, he knew that postmodernism and a what is truth default was destroying his paper, and he wrote a big piece in the Columbia Journalism Review. It's long. I loved it. It didn't get a lot of attention, I guess, in the world beyond journalism nerds, but he essentially backed the idea of objectivity. He was smart enough to know you couldn't endorse the word of objectivity, but having objectivity be a sort of guiding light, a North Star for you, has done journalism well for the last 80 years. And if you were to say, what about activism? That can actually exist within the world of objectivity. Ida B. Wells is not a rebuke of what objective journalism can be. Ida B. Wells exists within the tradition of journalism that allows for objectivity. So Sulzberger, he called it independence journalism because he knows you can't say objectivity. That should be the way that our media is going. Thankfully, it is the way that the New York Times is trending. It is not the way that at least this CEO, who we are assured will have no impact on content, so let's hire her, that is not the way that the CEO, at least her track record, has indicated what she believes. If you want to, I'll ask you, do you want to hear me talk more about the Uri Berliner Free Press essay? Do you want, or is this too, look, we know it, we enjoy the puns, and we like the occasional conversation with the guy who writes for the Family Guy, and maybe a little less Israel Mike, but if you want me to get into it, I can. I guess I'm taking requests. Also, in general, leave a review. I never say this enough. Leave a review on, people say a 5-star review. Leave as many stars you want on iTunes. Thanks a lot. Thanks for listening to me. Thanks for being engaged in this exercise in objectivity. On the show today, I answer the question that most people know the answer to. Why is it that Ukraine can't have as robust a defense against incoming missiles as Israel does? But first, Evan Waite is a co-executive producer of Fox's Family Guy. It means he's a mainstay in the writer's room. And he's written for The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Loved it. Sunnyside, The President Show, The Onion. He's an Onion alum. And he's out with a new book, Life Wants You Dead, a calm, rational, and totally legit guide to scaring yourself safe. Evan Waite, up next.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends, so for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Scientists and sociologists have discovered a phenomenon with 100% mortality. There are no survivors to even interview. There are many people walking around right now who say it's not going to happen to me. So far, all of them have been proved wrong. We have to withhold judgment on if this will always be the case. Science is forever coming up with solutions to address this problem, but none are an actual cure. It's just palliative care. What am I speaking of? Life, of course, life. This is the subject of Life Wants You Dead, a calm, rational, and totally legit guide to scaring yourself straight. It is written by Evan Waite, who is a comedy writer for such places as The Onion, Family Guy, The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Evan, welcome to The Gist.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Are you a neurotic, fearful, fretful person? Or perhaps your lack of fear and fretfulness empowers you to just help others?
Well, I didn't think that I was a fearful person. I thought I was actually very level-headed. But the pandemic actually told me that I was exactly the opposite of that. So yeah, I was suddenly in just a terrified state all of a sudden. It was like a light switch had been flipped and I didn't even recognize who I'd become.
Yeah. And so during the pandemic, it is true, you were presented with more evidence of the deadliness of life. Life got a bit more deadly during that time. So coming out the other end of it, I guess what? You turned it into art, or it made you realize that you had been wrong the whole time? If there was a pandemic between 2020 and perhaps a little bit ongoing, why not everything else that is in our environment that we've been taking for granted that actually wants to kill us?
Yeah, it really opened my eyes to the fear cornucopia that was presented to us. And I remember at my lowest point wiping down a potato with a Clorox wipe and thinking, This doesn't seem like a good thing.
No, one of those parts that might kill you, but not the potato.
Yeah, it was, I realized that, maybe I'd been a little bit blind to the dangers that were all around us. And so I came out the other end with a more finely tuned sense of, the dangers that could give me problems.
Evan, I'm not an agronomist nor a galophile, but do you have any evidence that the Irish potato famine might have been forestalled if Clorox wipes were more readily available?
I have thought about that, and I think that Clorox really dropped the ball by not creating their product 50 years before.
That's right. As everyone knows this, so we're on the same page. What are some of the things in your book that you put your finger on that experts before you fail to realize as the threat that they were? I'm thinking of maybe what if lupus arms itself with a gun, but can you talk about some other threats and fears that we've been taking too lightly?
Well, one thing I have learned to be very concerned about is the threat of cannibals, which is something that a lot of people don't think about. And the problem is that as humans, we are very delicious. And the biggest issue is if we can make ourselves taste worse, then therefore they won't want to eat us and they'll want to eat somebody else. So in the book, there's a recipe about how to make yourself taste very terrible to any cannibals who might want to try to bite you.
You know, I've often thought about this, but there is a body of evidence about beings that want to eat other beings without even knowing how the other beings taste. I'm thinking of Gargamel and the Smurfs, right? There is no evidence that Gargamel has ever eaten a Smurf. Also, Alf with cats.
Yes.
Right? I mean, was there ever a scene in Alf with just a cat skeleton and fur? I mean, that would be a little bit too dark. You're a comedy writer. I don't know. But maybe they should have established that he actually has a taste for cats based on experience.
Yeah. I mean, in the case of Alf, we've seen him chase cats, but we've never seen him actually consume one. And so that feels like that's a bit of supposition on our part.
Or maybe it's like the big talking guy in high school about his sexual conquests. And then, you know, if he ever comes in contact with a girl, he turns to Jell-O. Maybe Alf's just talking a big cat game.
He's a coward. Disgusts me.
Well, I'm thinking of the same of cannibals. Like, do we know that they actually, have we done the ethnography where we've surveyed them and asked them, what about people is so delicious?
I mean, I'm not sure the scientific basis for it, but I do know that when I walk around, I see a lot of people eyeing up my calves.
Uh-huh. That's good. Well, what do you mean you haven't done the scientific? That's science right there. Did you generate a chart based on it?
You know, I think that I know what I'm feeling when I go out there, you know.
That's important. Your lived experience.
Absolutely.
I can't gainsay that. I can't push you off that, Evan. What about, there are lots of charts in your book, the illustrator's Paula Searing. There's a version of the New York City subway map. Describe that if you will, because most of my listeners know hearing about the visual in an audio form is all the more satisfying.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the book is all about identifying fears, and there's different pathways of fears. You know, there's different emotional sort of, you know, pathways that you have to deal with. So, for instance, all the different emotions. There's fear. There's there's sex. There's random thoughts that course through your mind. And so the map is just a representation of your mind. And then all the different pathways are ones that have different jokes about the fears that belong to those different emotions.
Now that more and more people are getting pushed in front of the actual subway, does that emphasize the chart, make it all the more salient, or undercut the chart comparing deadliness to subways?
Well, look, I mean, it is about fear. And when you step in the subway, sometimes you do have certain fears. You know, there's an unsettlingness to being around all these different people you don't know. And there's just a lot of energy coming your way. So, you know, I've had some weird experiences on the subway. I lived in New York for 8 years, and, you know, sometimes you step on the wrong car.
Now, far be it from you to criticize Amazon, but I see in the bestseller rank, here are the three categories it's selling well in. And it's not, well, as of our speaking, it's not out yet, so you would excuse it for not being in the top 10 yet, but it is charting in parody. That's the number one category. We could talk about that. Survival and emergency preparedness, that's right below parody. And then further down, sociology, parentheses, books. Would you like a recategorization? I mean, look, if you sell in the survival and emergency preparedness category, that's fine. You'll take the sale. But do you have any warning for anyone who would buy your book while looking under that category to prepare themselves?
Well, I do think that the advice is pretty terrible, but
okay,
you know,
that's good.
But it is authoritative. It's stated in a very confident way. So, look, I mean, it's better to make a decision than to make none at all. So.
There seems to be a few kinds of, okay, that's interesting that you say the advice is terrible, because there's probably a few categories of advice. There's a category of advice that's terrible because it won't work, but there's also the category of advice that's terrible because the threat isn't real. Are there have you noted that about your book? Like, there's a couple kinds of, I guess you could say, parody, or there's a few types of exaggeration. You're making fun of the overly anxious, and you're also making fun of the person who thinks they could do anything about the inevitability of being killed.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately life has inherent risk and danger to it if you're going to actually live a life. And the only way to really protect yourself against all threats is to hunker down and just never leave your house, never do anything. It's like the more you shrink your life down, the safer you will be, but the less you will be living it. So some of the advice, while it could make you safer, it will actually ruin your life if you implement it. So there's the dichotomy of life is inherently a dangerous proposition. That's just what it is. So because, you know, during the pandemic, I found myself sort of shrinking my life down. And I was like, well, I feel safer now, but this is just like not really a good way to live either. So there's this yin and yang there.
Do you like neurotic type comedy, the Woody Allen? I mean, Woody Allen, is, I know you've written for The New Yorker, you know, putting aside anything else you think about Woody Allen, the guy's an incredible writer. But there is a strain of comedy that mines the anxiety of oneself. It often shows, Jewish comedy is very much like this. It often shows up in the pages of The New Yorker. Is that one of your favorite types of comedy?
I mean, I just like comedy that has a point of view. Mm-hmm. You know, a comedy that is trying to say something and is sort of has a consistent voice. You know, I think that sometimes when jokes are just completely scattered, but there's not like a framework to it, then I get a little lost in it. So, you know, anybody, like, for instance, you know, my first comedy gig was at The Onion, which has a very consistent voice. And so it kind of helps you understand where it's coming from.
Yeah, if The Onion's take apart the comedy of The Onion. Just give me a thesis statement. You know, through comedy, we're pointing out what? What's The Onion, or when you were there, what do you think The Onion's trying to do?
I think it's just pointing out hypocrisy in the world and in ourselves. Yeah.
Yes. I think it's doing something like holding up official statements and ways of thinking for ridicule to create the effect of exactly that, pointing out that we're riven with hypocrisy, and, you know, it helps to notice it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that when you are able to see it within yourself, that it doesn't feel like an indictment of everybody else, like you're just pointing the finger outwards. It's also us that have all these inconsistencies and issues, and it's just sort of a two-way street.
Mm-hmm. What's the thesis statement of the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt? Apart from the comedy, what is it trying to say, if anything?
Yeah, I think that Kimmy Schmidt, she had a very tough situation. Where, you know, she was kidnapped and, you know, a lot of terrible things happened to her, but she never lost that childlike sense of optimism and she kept going with her life. And there's something very endearing about that and positive. And it bounces out the insanity of the comedy.
Yeah, there's a lot of horrors in Kimmy Schmidt, but it's almost literally portrayed through a certain lens, like the funny, happy quirkiness, and it's shot in bright colors. And just by changing a perspective, I don't know, 10 or 15 degrees, it is pointing out consciously or unconsciously, something like your book is doing, that the horrors of the world can be processed in different ways. And there is an absurdity to a lot of terrible things.
Yeah, I think it would be very easy for that character to just give up and say, you know, I was dealt a horrible hand and, you know, I should just wrap it up. But, you know, she kept going and she kept building, you know, she was rebuilding her life. And I think there's something really nice about that. And it's a very sweet kind of mentality to have.
When you were writing on Kimmy Schmidt, were there some characters that you resonated with or the other way around, that you were the, I don't know, you were the Kimmy guy or you were the Titus guy?
I mean, I would have to say I'm a Titus guy. I mean, to me, to me, he's one of the great characters of all time. I mean, it's just
right.
It's just fantastic. And how heightened he is really resonates with me. I remember there was a joke in the last season where Titus, he looked at his own feet and thought that his own toes were caramels. And he tried to reach to get the caramels and he just fell on his back and he was just like on the floor like the turtle. And it's just like that kind of heightened sensibility really resonates with me in a big way.
Wait, did you write that? Did you put him in that turtle, that tortine position?
It wasn't my joke, but I just remember when it was pitched and laughing about it as I was driving home that day.
Do you remember any of Titus's or anyone else's great lines? Did they come from your pen and mind? Can you think of one?
You know,
I don't even know if that's like verboten to do after the collaboration of a writer's room.
It's not verboten, but I have a terrible memory. I mean, once you get in a writer's room, even the next day, you have a very hard time remembering who pitched what.
Gotcha. What's the thesis of Family Guy?
Well, Family Guy is really just a funny first proposition. That's really the only North Star of the show is just like comedy, comedy, comedy. And it's a very anarchic type of show because, you know, somebody can die in one second and then the next second they're back. And it's just like there's a very strange logic to it.
Right. Right. It's very efficient as a joke delivery system, right? They've created all this scaffolding that you can have all these different kinds of jokes flying in from all these different places. And that's what it is.
Yeah. And like the cutaways, those are essentially like little Far Side cartoons where you create a setup and then you pay it off with a joke and then you're out. Like it's a very efficient form of comedy, which I feel is one of the reasons why it does so well on the internet. Because you can really chop it up, and you know, it's like it's almost like drugs in a way. You know, it's like cocaine. You can chop it up in any different way and bag it up, and then people are all into it.
Right, it's memeable. They say cats are very good on the internet because they're ambush predators, so they're quiet, quiet, quiet. Boom, and that actually works out pretty well for shareable internet memes. Family Guy's kind of like that too.
Yeah, it's. You know, I think that The Onion was a very good training for that because it's just very discrete comedy idea. Then you flesh it out and then you move on to another thing. It's like it's very segmented in that way.
Yeah, but The Onion is a very it's very structured, but it's also I'm not going to say limiting. I mean, within structure, creativity flourishes. But The Onion, most funny thoughts in the world, I think, I mean, maybe if you're an Onion writer and you're a funny person and you're thinking in terms of how do I make this funny thought into an Onion headline and column, you could do that with more things than I'd imagine. But my basic point here is that it does seem like The Onion is funny and excellent, but also pretty restrictive in what would be an Onion joke, whereas Family Guy is much more open and anarchic, and you could get a lot more types of humor in there. Or am I wrong? Am I misconceiving this?
Well, I mean, honestly, I never felt constrained by The Onion. I like the constraints of the format, because within that format, you can kind of make any joke you want as long as you can structure it within that way. But, you know, obviously being on TV is different than reading something in prose. Because TV, you know, right. You have the benefit of, like, the funniest voice actors on the planet who can now, like, make something so much funnier. And so I never felt constricted on either side, to be honest. I really...
Well, there are jokes on Family Guy that are character jokes, right? Like it's funny because we know who Stewie is and he says that. Is such a thing? I know The Onion has their six men on the street clip art people, but is there such a thing with The Onion, character humor?
Well, yeah. I mean, there was a period where Joe Biden was sort of like caricatured as this sort of white trash, you know, maniac.
Trans Am loving, yeah.
Yeah, that sort of changed over the years. But like when he was vice president, that was his character. And, you know, they have Pete Buttigieg, who's treated as like almost like a little child who likes trains. And he's just like a little simpleton. And so there are these characters that do emerge. And they usually it revolves around like a political figure. And then as they sort of disappear from the landscape, then that character tends to disappear.
It's funny because Biden is, and I think wants to promote the image that something like that Trans Am guy. I mean, he wants to be seen as a world leader, but also I love trains and I'm a car guy. And he kind of loves that regular Joe type of stuff. Whereas Buttigieg, I mean, the guy, you know, picks up Norwegian and becomes conversant in 6 months and can sit down and do a concerto on a piano. So one is the comedy of the 80% overlap and the other is the comedy of direct difference.
Yeah, I mean, Pete Buttigieg, you don't get to a place like that without being a brilliant, brilliant person. But there's nothing funny about like a brilliant and competent guy. Like there's not much humor there. So it's just like you have to see what is an angle you can kind of feast on, and then you just go all in.
Yeah. I would say you can get to transportation secretary without being a brilliant guy. I think the history of the cabinet shows us that, you know.
I mean, there are exceptions. There are exceptions.
Yes. So with how many writers are on Family Guy?
I'd say there's about, I think, 20, maybe 22. There's a couple of consulting people who come in just from time to time.
Wow. And so from what I understand about writing rooms, there are plot specialists and then there are gag specialists. And I was reading about how you've got to be good at plot these days. And I say plot, I mean character, plot, development, story, all that. The writing room will have one or two gag guys. But are there some people in the Family Guy writing room who are just great at those cutaway gags, those Far Side cartoons? That's their specialty.
Yeah, I would say there are, you know, people who just sort of are so fluent in that language that they just are bursting with ideas. And but I will say that, like, on different days, some people are down and some people are up. It's like not everybody has to be crushing that day, because as long as a couple of people are, then, you know, everything kind of balances out. Because people, you know, sometimes people had a bad day that morning, or they had a fight right with their wife, and they just show up and they're not like at their top peak capacity. But for me, you know, I definitely lean more towards the gag side, just from The Onion. Like, I was trained to just crank out ideas, and that really served me well with the book, because that's sort of what it is. It's just like these discrete comedy ideas, and you just have to flesh it out, and that definitely helped.
I'm talking with Evan Waite, a writer for Family Guy, wrote for The Onion. His new book is Life Wants You Dead, a calm, rational, totally legit guide to scaring yourself safe. Pascal Plus subscribers will get more of the conversation, including my asking Evan about The Onion's recent humor. Israel, Hamas, how to find the funny in that? And now you may be asking, Pascal Plus, huh? Yes, paying subscribers are part of an exclusive club that gets longer interview cuts. We don't rob the non-Pascal Plus subscribers. We just give more to the Pascal Plus subscribers. More gistness, fun events, and the like. No ads either. There's a no ad option. It's all there at subscribe.mikepesca.com to learn about membership. And now the spiel. A political report on a question that Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is pushing to his allies. The question is, if the United States and his allies can rush to Israel's defense in its skies, shooting down dozens of drones and missiles fired by Iran, why can't they do the same for Ukraine, which has suffered under missile attacks for more than 2 years? Don't want to paraphrase? Want that question asked directly? Well, I'll quote Sir Robin Niblett, who sounds like he may cavort with Chicken Little or Henny Penny, but no, he's actually Sir Robin Niblett, is a British expert on foreign relations, and he asked on Twitter, U.S., U.K., French forces shoot down Iranian missiles and drones targeting Israel without having to hit Iran. Why don't we shoot down Russian drones and missiles penetrating Ukraine's sovereign territory? To which Gerard Aroud, the former French ambassador to the U.S. and Israel and the U.N., he answered, good question indeed. I guess he didn't answer. He just perpetuated the question. But I can give the answer. I can give the answer why the United States and the Western allies don't shoot down all the rockets aimed from Russia. And the answer is, and those guys are, I'm going to acknowledge, at least as smart as I am, they know their stuff. They know the answer. It's because Iran is not Russia. How isn't Iran Russia? Iran, key difference, does not have nuclear weapons, and Russia does. Everyone asking these questions knows this, and everyone asking these questions also understands the implications, and that's pretty much it. You have nuclear weapons as a country, you have one set of rules, all the other countries, different set of rules. Every good actor and bad actor in the world knows this. That's why they all, the bad actors, all want nuclear weapons. I understand that the question isn't always asked in an earnest search of an answer. And that doesn't mean it's dishonest. It's asked to make a point. Here's House of Representatives member Mike McCaul, Republican of Texas, on Face the Nation.
These rockets and these drones are being bought by Russia, and they're killing Ukrainians every day. What happened in Israel last night happens in Ukraine every night.
That's a good point. I get it. It also demands that explanation that everyone speaking the words knows and doesn't need to hear, that nuclear weapons change everything. There are, by the way, still elements in the aid package that could buttress Iranian air defenses, and it's not like all Western allies can't do anything to shoot rockets, Russian attacks out of the sky, but it does stay their hand to quite a degree. The implication of knowing all this in the Ukrainian theater is you've got to find ways to work around the restrictions of opposing a nuclear enemy. In the case of Israel, it's a little different. It's annoying to me that we have to take the fact around Iran that they are not a nuclear state, but never credit that fact for not having a major effect on how well Israel and the US and France and the UK and Jordan defend itself. The defense of Israel, not popular at all, but certainly a very mainstream opinion in United States politics. No one wanted Israelis dead by those Iranian strikes. No one that I know of who would speak of publicly, who's an elected official. But why? Why could there be that defense? Why isn't, it needs to be asked, why isn't Iran a nuclear state? It's not like a natural law. It's not like, well, Iran is mountainous and it is also not a nuclear state. It's not even a fact. Like, Iran has the biggest mall in the world. It does, you know. No, Iran is not a nuclear state because Israel and the United States have worked very hard to keep it from becoming a nuclear state. The U.S. sends Stuxnet and other cyber weapons. The U.S., most likely, certainly Israel, with the U.S.'s blessing and assistance, assassinates Iranian nuclear scientists and the occasional general. So I guess what's happening to the median American, who cares about such things, they looked at the Iran attack against Israel and they, I do think, said, well, thank goodness no one was killed. And they know Iran is bad and Israel, I don't know if they think Israel is good or bad, but they don't want innocent people to be killed. They might be impressed at the anti-ballistic missile system and David Sling and the Iron Beam and the Iron Dome. They might be impressed that the air forces of Israel, UK, France, Jordan work so well. But they might also be saying, again, these are the ones playing close attention. They might be saying, but why does Israel have to go and provoke Iran by killing that general? The answer is so that they could defend themselves when attacked by a non-nuclear state. If a defense is seen as a provocation by a non-nuclear state, and you can repeat that defense, I mean, it's burdensome and costly, but not costly in lives, to just repeat the defense. But if a defense is seen as a provocation by a nuclear state, it's an entirely different set of considerations we're seeing now in Ukraine. I understand that Americans or people out of war zones want peace. They want de-escalation. They want potential enemies not to strike each other. When Israel strikes the Iranians, they said, ooh, that could go very badly. When the Iranians strike back, they said, see, that's what we mean. We're wise. We get it. You don't. But you got to think more than a week and a half ahead of time. You got to think of maybe second and third order effects. If Israel doesn't engage in these targeted killings, distasteful though they are, the U.S. too, by the way, and doesn't use all the various spycraft and cyber weapons and all the other tactics of keeping Iran from nuclearizing, then Iran certainly would nuclearize. And then a defense of Israel would be much less possible. And Israelis would lose lives in an international attack. Play it out. Think ahead. Almost every provocation, like killing a general, can be seen as a proactive defense. But to be fair, that means the stupid proactive defenses or provocations and the smart ones. I don't know if killing these particular Iranian generals were good calls, but it is what Israel does, and it is what Israel has been doing to keep the Iranians from developing a nuclear program and fomenting their discord abroad. It's what the United States did when they killed, or when we killed under Donald Trump, Qasem Soleimani. So if you were happy that no Israeli died in the attack, because you're a good person, you don't want that to happen, but you also put a lot of stock in the supposed idea of aggressive steps taken to rob Iran of the world's most dangerous weapon, and you think that Israel shouldn't be so aggressive. I don't know. I don't know how it all affects your status as a peace activist. Probably a peace activist or someone who believes in peace wouldn't like any war, but some war beforehand, some amount of small wars have allowed for a situation where larger wars don't occur. It's not an easy calculation, but you have to put these considerations into the mix. I, again, have no idea if it was smart to kill the Iranian general or all of the Hezbollah members that Iran is striking, sometimes deep inside Lebanon. Maybe not all the sons of all the head of Hezbollah. Hassem Mizrahi, I don't know, maybe two of the sons, let one live to tell the story. I don't know if every individual choice has been the right one, but those are exactly the kind of choices you have to make. And if you always choose not to make the hard choices, and you're Israel, you're going to be attacked and you're going to lose a lot of lives. I see this all as a piece with the overall goal of peace for Israel, a peace that you might think is impossible, but that they carved out with historical enemies. And it is a peace that isn't as easily afforded to Ukraine as everyone asking the questions certainly understands. That's it for today's show. The show is produced by the Quaint Mallards. Corey Warr is the producer and Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca spearheads special projects for us at Peachfish. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Get your ads on the gist. Get out to a upwardly mobile audience of people who believe in peace and maybe the occasional, let's not call it a targeted killing, but just, you know, doing what needs to be done. Umpuru, jipuru, dupuru, and thanks for listening.